All right, welcome to episode 14 of the Watchwell podcast. My name is Parker, and this is my co-host, Nick. How's it going, Nick?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing great. It was a great week. It's a busy week, but it was a great week so far.
Great week?
Great week, yeah. I mean, we're recording. Today's Thursday. You guys will be listening to this tomorrow, Friday. Hopefully get this up tonight. Tonight's episode, we are doing a movie review through the lens of truth on the movie Inception.
Mm-hmm.
Christopher Nolan.
Yes.
It's been a Christopher Nolan kind of like couple months, hasn't it been?
Well, I mean, when we do the Batman trilogy, the Dark Knight trilogy, it's got to be, I mean.
Right, absolutely.
It's four movies counting today, so.
I have a question for you, and this is just off the cuff, so I know that I'm going to catch you off guard here a little bit. If you had to pick the movie, I think I know your pick because I think you're biased. But if you had to pick, if you have to pick out of Christopher Nolan's movies that we've done so far in terms of reviews, what movie would you pick for best sound, the best sound design? It's really tough.
Wow,
because they're all amazing.
It's either this one or The Dark Knight.
Yeah,
because so like,
so you pick the violin or the whatever that string instrument they use for the Joker. That's pretty epic.
Yeah.
It's very epic. It's so simple, but it's perfect for the suspense and the eeriness of the Joker.
Yeah, and it just builds tension.
Absolutely.
Like, you feel the tension of it, especially in that scene with, now we're talking about The Dark Knight again, but the scene with the convicts and then the citizens on the boats.
Absolutely.
Like, when it just crescendos and it like builds tension really well. So I wouldn't pick The Dark Knight Rises just because there's some, it's like there's difficulty with hearing certain things, I feel like. Some stuff is too quiet and it doesn't come out like it should. But Inception, I feel like, is really, it kind of has the same feel, especially with the music and so like the score and the way it fits into the, to each scene, it like enhances it so much.
Right. And I have to, I don't know if you're going this way with it, but I think I do have to disagree on the balance of the audio of the movies, because when I watch The Dark Knight, I don't have to turn the volume up and down as much as I do when I watch Inception.
There's huge big parts. Yeah.
Inception is absolutely horrendous with the balance of the audio in terms of, you know, like the action scenes and the audio are super, super loud. But then when they're talking, it's so quiet and you can't hear anything.
Yeah,
turn it up.
I think that might,
I hate it.
That might have something to do with how you're watching it too.
You think?
Did you stream it or did you watch a hard copy?
Hard copy.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know. Because I watched it. I've seen the hard copy countless times, but the most recent time that I watched it was on HBO Max. So I don't know. Maybe HBO Max does something where they even out the audio, like they compress it somehow, and it's more even. Because I didn't notice that on HBO Max.
Maybe, I don't know.
But I might have noticed it if I would have watched the Blu-ray.
Yeah, I'm not sure, but I actually thought it to be rather annoying. And
okay.
I didn't remember that from the first time I watched it, to be completely honest. I didn't have any remembrance of that. But
You're getting older.
I am getting older. The hearing is going a little bit, you know, sore.
A little more sensitive.
I will say that. And, you know, back to the question of the better sound design, no movie like Inception is known for its sound. So when someone says Inception horn, most people know what that is.
I've actually never heard that term before.
It's an Inception. You know what I mean when I say it, though.
Yeah, I know what you say, yeah.
So in terms of, I know I say in terms a lot, but when we're talking about sound design, if you're talking about, like, sound branding, I don't know if that's a thing. Everyone knows what an Inception horn is, even if they haven't heard the term before. So I think that's interesting too. So the wah, like, you know, that noise, the horns.
Yeah.
That's a big deal that you can technically brand a movie, or a movie's known, or the sounds are known by the movie.
Right. And that's basically the loudest thing in the movie too, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
That's probably the point where you have to turn it down.
Yeah.
Is anytime that the horn comes up.
And it's almost the horns are almost they almost drowned out all the explosions, because usually the horns are happening when the climax of a scene is occurring.
Right.
And it's about to, you know, like the main is when they're what are they called again? I want to say the jumps, but that doesn't sound right.
The kicks
when they're coming out of the dreams and they're riding the kicks out of the dreams. I think for sure that's one of the big things is suspense and ultimate suspense and racing time, and that just that Inception horns just I think it works for the movie, but it can be overplayed in other things.
Yeah.
For sure.
And so Hans Zimmer is same guy is did the score for the movie.
He's done
like
lots
it's incredible.
Of
it's incredible. Done. He did all of the Batman movies.
Yep.
He's done a lot. I can listen to the score for this movie just on its own.
Yeah,
even
absolutely.
Without watching
100%, 100%. Do you know if I want to actually look that up? That would be interesting. Let's see. If you want to run through the, I know we talked a little bit about the ratings.
Yeah, we can do that. I'll do that real quick. So this movie's too old for plugged-in movie reviews. There is a review that exists, but it doesn't have the content cautions because this movie was released in 2010 and they weren't yet providing that piece of information. So we don't have that.
Okay.
On Common Sense does give it a rating, says 14 plus, or so that's Common Sense. The official rating is 14 plus, but parents say that it can be 12 plus and kids say that it can be 12 plus. And then the movie's rated PG-13 for sequences of violence and action throughout. And that's it. That's enough for the PG-13 rating. So while you're looking up whatever question you're trying to answer there, what do you think of those?
I think the biggest thing that I would say is outside of language, I think that I would let a much younger kid listen or watch this movie as opposed to the Batman movies.
Yeah, it's not as scary. There's a couple scenes that kind of are horror-esque. Like they feel like they could have been ripped right out of a scene out of a horror movie, but in the context of this movie, they don't come off that way. You know what I'm talking about?
What scenes would you be specifically talking about? That's interesting to me.
So in terms of horror-esque, the one of the main scenes I'm talking about is when Ariadne, it's the first time she's sharing the dream with Cobb, and she's trying to figure out what's going on in his mind and why is he doing this? Where is his, and all of the kind of things we'll get into in a little bit, and she goes down the elevator and arrives in the hotel room where we eventually find out this is the place that, that Cobb's wife committed suicide. And Cobb's wife kind of walks up to her with this shard of glass. And that whole scene, I feel like it could be ripped out of a horror movie. In the context, it doesn't really come off that way, but to a kid, it could be kind of scary because it's very, very, very obvious that if it were real, Cobb's wife would be killing Ariadne.
Right. No, that definitely makes sense. Let's see. Yeah, for the ratings, language, I think that, you know, taking the Lord's name in vain is obviously not what we want our kids listening to. That would be the biggest concern. There's really not. I can't even think of any suggestive like sexual scenes that I remember.
Not really at all. And there's not
outside of the kiss at the very end or at the climax of the movie.
And even though there's a lot of violence, there's not blood or gore.
Yeah, the only blood would be when I'm gonna do really bad on the character names for this one. I don't have them memorized, but the guy that gets shot.
Saito.
Saito. You just see blood on his shirt. I mean, I don't even think that they went as far as to do a bullet hole wound.
Yeah, you just see the blood.
So,
yeah. So it's not very graphic at all.
No, not at all.
So with...
Is there anything about this...
No,
sorry,
you go
ahead. I was going to say, is there anything about this movie that you didn't like?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, let's start there.
We'll start there. they talk too much. They talk too much about what they're doing rather than demonstrating it. Kind of, there was another movie that we had that same complaint about. I think it was The Dark Knight Rises. We had that same complaint about. And I think this movie has that, not as bad as The Dark Knight Rises, but it has that tendency too, where where there's too much explaining. Like, and obviously there's a lot that the audience has to try to understand. So some explaining is necessary, but there's too much of it, I feel like. And it gets, after you've seen the movie a few times, those parts of the film can kind of drag.
Yeah, I don't know if I disagree with that. I think that that's fair. I think the nature of the film does require more commentary than The Dark Knight Rises. Mm-hmm. I don't think The Dark Knight Rises needed as much commentary. Right. I think this rides the fence a little better, because when you start talking about dreams within a dream, and you start talking about scenes and transitions from one scene to another scene, it can get very easy to get confused as the viewer. I think there could be a debate about how much talking, but I don't know if I could disagree with your.
There were some things that they showed you, like when they're practicing, basically. So when Cobb is bringing Ariadne in and showing her what it's like sharing a dream, like they show you things in there, but then after they've shown you, they feel like they need to tell you. And I can't think of anything really specific off the top of my head. I just think they still could have pulled some of that out and the audience would still know what's going on. So it's not a huge complaint, just one small criticism, and it's probably the only one I have.
Yeah, I'm trying to think.
So like the math stuff about the difference in time. The audience doesn't necessarily need to know the exact math about how the difference in time in each dream works. As long as the audience knows that the characters know that, and we know that the time is different, we don't necessarily need to know the exact math of that. And they go into that detail. And I just think something like that might be unnecessary.
Yeah, that could be fair. I think I would have to say that I think they tried too hard on the visual. I don't even know I don't even know the words to say it, but like with the stairs that they did, how they did,
the paradox
thing.
What
was the paradox thing? I think that they tried too hard. I think it's a cool idea. Don't get me wrong. I think it's a great idea. I think they tried too hard though, because I understand that you're in a dream and you're outside of physics and you're outside of laws of everything.
Right. It's just however your brain works.
Right. And I don't think that it was bad to use those ideas. I think that they could have done a better job at, one, showing, I think they could have done a better job at showing it on screen outside of just having a city fold in on itself. And then two, I think they could have tied off the loose ends a little better when they're talking about the different stairs and stuff like that. I don't know. Just I think that could have been done a little better. You know, because like if you look at the Doctor Strange movies.
I haven't.
You haven't seen those? You haven't seen the Doctor Strange movies? Okay, so I watched the first one, and then some of the other ones the Marvel movies where he's kind of in them, but they're not like specifically about Doctor Strange. And I think those movies are so visually stunning in that like world that and I know that they're newer and they're building off of Inception and it kind of paved the way. So I think that you have to give a little bit of grace there, but I still think that they could have done a better job.
Okay.
Because there's a lot of some of the same, movie magic done in the Doctor Strange movies that is directly carbon copy from carbon copied but improved from Inception. The city folding itself on each other and but it's just better.
So obviously I didn't intend to do it all, for my opinion. Like I just couldn't even get into it in the slightest. But so I know what scene you're talking about. But the thing I disagree about those scenes being better, because they're completely 100% computer generated in Doctor Strange. And in Inception, they actually do stuff and only enhance it with computer graphics.
I think that's
and
fair.
And I like...
I can get behind that. I can get behind that.
But that, I mean, that's going to be, you know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder kind of thing. What you prefer. Do you prefer the computer generated stuff where it's really clean images and things like that? Or do you prefer the practical real life effects that might have some enhancement from graphics and things like that, but they're basically just things that they did? And I mean, people are going to differ on how you feel about that. I always prefer the real life stuff. So as much as possible, actually doing it in real life, like for example, the spinning hallway, right? They built a set.
Yeah.
That was a hallway that spins.
Right.
Right. That's awesome to me. I love stuff like that. As opposed
to I love stuff that too. But when you have a building folding over on another building, or city rather, folding on another city, that's going to be 80 to 90% computer generated, no matter what you do. And to your point, maybe they built a very small set.
They did miniatures, I think.
And they did miniatures. That's still not real.
But I even prefer stuff like that over.
I think where I stand would be I think I can have more of an appreciation for how it's filmed, but the end result still is all I care about.
And you think the other one looks better?
Yeah, but I think they cheated because I think they copied it and then made it better. So,
yeah. So let's you said you're going to have trouble memorizing or remembering the character name. So let's go through that real quick. So first, the main character.
Perfect.
And by the way, I agree with you on how old kids should be to watch this. I'm fine with younger kids watching this. There's no reason that a 10-year-old couldn't watch this movie. So
I agree.
I
would monitor them.
Other than they might not be able to follow it. It might be a lot to take in and a lot to follow.
I agree. 100% agree.
In terms of content.
So content is not, I don't think it's a maturity issue in terms of like protecting innocence in the movies. I think it's, I don't know if it's like having a 10-year-old watch The Matrix. They're not going to get it. So I agree with that.
Right. We have
characters.
We have Cobb, who is the main character. He is he's the main guy the whole movie, and it's basically his story that we're following. You know, he has you see him, he's the one pushing the story forward. He's also the one who causes problems in the story. So it's almost like, and I'll get your perspective on this, that Cobb, because the problems come from Cobb's mind, it's like he's the hero and the villain all at the same time. Right? So the main villain isn't actually his wife, it's his own mental image of his wife. So his mind is the hero and the villain all at the same time, but he's the main character. He has been charged with the murder of his wife, and he is trying desperately to get back to his kids. And that's the basic, at the most basic level, that's the story right there. Cobb wants to be with his children, and he can't.
Right. Right.
And then you have his friend, his sidekick, Arthur, who is right there at the beginning of the film. He's the guy, he gets shot in the head in the dream level, and that's when we learn that when you die in the dream, you wake up, right? So that's Arthur. He's also the guy that gets the experience of fighting in that spinning hallway, and he has to figure out how to drop everyone for the final kick in the movie. They have to get back to reality and all of that. Anything to say about Arthur? Anything to say about him?
I like his character. I don't have much to say. I think he does a good job. Yeah, that's what I got. I think he does a good
then
job.
Then we have Ariadne, who's recruited by Cobb to be the architect. Somebody has to build these dream levels, build them out and make them look real. And she's the character that, that does that, recruits her from his. So this is kind of debated, and I'm not sure, is the guy that plays Alfred, Michael Caine, do you think he is Cobb's father or father-in-law?
I don't know. I didn't think
because of it. I think he's Cobb's father-in-law.
Okay.
He seems to be, like, because he's going back to the States and Cobb asks him to drop things off for the kids. So I don't know if he's Cobb's father or father-in-law, but he's definitely the guy that's trained him. And Cobb is coming to the university where he teaches and is recruiting from him. Wants him to give Cobb a student to build these dream levels. And Ariadne's the student that gets the spot. And she's hesitant at first, but then eventually it's kind of like they paint the picture that sharing these dreams is like a drug, and she can't, once you've done it, you can't just go without it anymore. You've got to come back to it. And she does. And then we have Eames. This is the guy that is, what do they call him? What do they call him? He's the guy that like plays different characters in the dream. Do you remember what they call him?
I don't remember.
He takes the image of different people by mimicking their mannerisms, like the way they walk, the way they talk. I can't remember the word. Why can't I remember? They make it really clear in the movie. I just can't remember what it is. But yeah, so I guess the thing that he's probably most known for is he's kind of the sarcastic guy. He's kind of has the one-liners and he's kind of funny. Anything on him?
No, man. I think everybody did a great job. I mean, this is a star-studded cast. Yeah. So, I mean, it's all brilliant.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Tom Hardy, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, you know, Leo. They're all great. Yeah. I mean, A-list.
Yep. Really good cast.
So, I don't... Cillian Murphy.
Yeah.
You can't go wrong with Cillian Murphy.
And so...
So, Yeah. I don't think I'm going to have much to say because they all did great. Yeah.
So rather than going through each character, then let's talk about how do you think it handles the various dream levels? Like, because I've heard people talk about the movie, and the first time they watch it, they say it's hard to follow. Do you feel like it's hard to follow where they are or anything like that?
I think my bigger question was, maybe you can help remind me, how many levels were there before you get to the pure subconscious level? Was it four?
Well, you have level one of the dream is where it's raining, and that's where the train comes through. That's where Saito gets shot. Level two of the dream is the hotel. And then level three is like, it's a hospital, but it looks more like a fortress. Like it's a snow fortress that looks like an army base, but it's a hospital.
Yeah, Ames is a forger, by the way.
Forger, yeah, that's the word.
He's a forger. Yeah. I just glad remembered. You looked that up. I actually looked it up. But I'll take credit for
there you go.
So
there's three, and then Limbo.
And then Limbo. Yeah. Okay, so I think they could have done a better job at why, and maybe I just completely missed this in the movie. But I think they could have done a better job at explaining why there's only four levels.
Yeah, they didn't even try.
So I would be more interested into why can you only go into why? Because that was throughout the movie. That was one of my biggest questions was, well, why not five? Mm-hmm. Why not six? You know, in this movie. You know. It's, you know, they're pretty much, whoever is dreaming is God, right?
Basically, yep.
So, if they're God in their dreams and they're in control of everything, why not be in control of how many times you can go inside your own dream?
Yeah, I don't know.
I think that they could have done a better job at structuring the rules around the dreams and explaining that so that there would be a little bit more significance to the viewer of, oh, it's a big deal that they're in limbo. Without that context, it's like, oh, they're just at the limbo.
But they do explain and they're gonna why come, it's bad to be in limbo.
They do, but why is it, why, like, I don't know. I think that outside of just, oh, the first three, to me, the first three are all the same outside of, what's his name? The guy that gets shot. Saito. He gets Saito. He gets his wound affects him less as the further he goes down until he gets to limbo and it stays right there.
But I think that's because they explain that it's the difference in time.
Yeah, so his wound is affecting him less.
It's the difference in time.
It's progressing less.
Yeah.
Yeah. But why? I think they could have, I think it would have given it a little bit more weight to say level one is not that big of a deal, and then level two is a big deal, and then it's a bigger deal. And then they did a good job at explaining the fourth, right?
The dangers of it.
But the dangers of the middle two, I think
there are no
done better.
There are no dangers other than this is just a dream,
and it's slower,
right?
Time or it takes long, like right? Slower, is that the right way to say that? Because it's taking time. Yeah. Like when I think of the dreams, I think of the movie
where time is moving with incredible. I don't know, incredibly fast, and it's.
It's incredibly fast because the previous level would have been slow
right.
compared to that.
Right.
It's like Interstellar with the gravity.
There's another movie we should talk about, another Nolan movie.
Yeah.
But Nolan loves so. Christopher Nolan loves to play with time. He loves that. Like, I don't know.
But I think it's interesting.
It is interesting.
And I think it's super interesting.
Because like one of his first movies was Memento. It was before Batman Begins, and it takes place backwards.
It does. Like, the whole movie is backwards.
He loves to mess with time.
But I think that's why it's so interesting because, I don't know, maybe, correct me if I'm wrong, but if we all know, it talks about in Romans, that we all know there's a creator because there's a creature. And maybe he's playing with time because the creator's outside of time, and there might be a connection there. It says that we know of a creator and we suppress it.
Yeah.
Maybe that's his way of trying to, I don't know, not suppressing part of that.
Maybe. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know intent. I know with Interstellar, he actually like consulted a physicist who has all kinds of black hole theories, and he was a consultant on the movie, so they incorporated his theories about black holes. And I'm sure there's a ton of research that went into this movie too, that similar type things. But he loves to mess with time. So what would you say? So actually, let's jump all the way to the end of the movie, because that's the biggest kind of discussion point for people after they're done watching it, is does the top fall?
At the very end.
It cuts before it falls. You see it kind of looks like it might be wobbling a little bit, but you never see it fall. And that's the indicator of whether, which there's a lot of different theories about this, fan theories everywhere, but the way the movie speaks, that's the indicator of whether Cobb is still dreaming or not. So is he dreaming or is he actually back with his kids?
You're asking me.
I'm asking you your opinion. Yeah.
I think he's back with his kids.
Why?
Because, and you're not going to like this answer, but because when the top start, when he spins the top and it's going axis over axis, the sheer fact that it started to wobble signifies that it's going to fall at some point based off of physics.
Right. Fair enough.
No other top. And then, in addition to that, I don't remember any other totem, or especially that specific totem, that top. I don't remember it ever wobbling when he spins it in a dream. It's just always perfectly end over end.
Because only he knows how it's supposed to work.
Yeah. Right.
And there's some
that's how I would build an argument, but I don't know if it's a good one.
And I don't know if that's necessarily a good argument either. I mean, I agree with you that I think just for the sake of the movie, I think he's in reality, and I think he's back with his kids.
Because it doesn't make sense to come out of limbo into another dream.
But the thought is he still in limbo and just believes himself to be awake?
Yeah, but then how would he? I don't know, because how would he? So then the plane would have been a dream,
right? Or his knowledge of the plane would have somehow caused him to dream of this in limbo, right?
I think that's a stretch.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know all the details of that, but there's a lot of people that think that it's not real. That it's not reality, that the top is going to keep spinning. And there was an interview with Christopher Nolan where he said, and I don't have the source or anything, but he said that it doesn't matter. And that's the point of the movie.
Interesting. I didn't hear that.
Because no matter what, from Cobb's perspective, he finally can look at the faces of his kids. And that's the one thing he wanted throughout the movie. So it doesn't matter if it's real or not. It doesn't matter if it's a dream, and doesn't matter if it's reality. Because the point of the movie was bringing Cobb to a place of healing where he can finally look at his kids' faces again.
Interesting. That actually makes sense. I like
that.
So
in that situation, the top spinning and that being an ending, that being the thing that everyone talks about, is actually just kind of a red herring. It's kind of just a distraction to get people,
because it doesn't matter.
Because it doesn't matter. And that could be the point. And I think he talked about that years and years after. I think he kind of, before that point, he kind of always said, just take the movie at face value. Like, just Cobb's back with his family, and that's just what it is. But then later, it was a more recent interview where he said, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if it's in reality or if it's in a dream. He can finally look at his kids' faces.
Yeah, but if it's in a dream, then why wouldn't he have stayed with Maul?
Because he doesn't know this is a dream. Because if you remember throughout the movie, he has to see the top fall, and he can't interact with anybody until he sees the top fall. Right? The totem has to fall over, and he won't interact or look at anybody until that happens. But at the very end, he spins it, and he hears his kids' voices and leaves while it's still spinning. He never sees it.
It's interesting.
So that signifies that he doesn't care anymore.
Right.
He's satisfied. Isn't that crazy?
So then let me ask you this question. Explain to me, because maybe I missed it. And what got him back to the States? The job that he did for the guy, did he buy it? Like, did he have some place of authority to where he bought his freedom back in the States?
That's what they say. Yeah. So that's,
but they don't mention anything outside of that.
He just assumes, but they show him. So that's the reason Cobb goes down into limbo, right? Is because Saito's in limbo, and he's worried that when Saito finally wakes up from limbo, he's going to have no knowledge. His brain's going to be mush. He's going to have no knowledge of the deal that they made.
Right.
And so with the deal that they made, you see when Cobb wakes up, Saito wakes up at the same time on the plane and grabs the phone and makes a phone call. So what?
You're supposed to assume that
he made the call to whoever he had to, so that Cobb could make his way through airport security and customs.
Gotcha. Yeah.
At least that's the way I watch it. Maybe someone else has a different opinion, and maybe that's not the way it is, but that's the way I've always thought of it.
Yeah, that's all. I mean, you mentioned face value before. That's how I took it. We're just left to assume that it worked out. Yeah, That's really good stuff, man. What did you have from like Bible application?
So a couple things. So like I said before, a lot of people that I've watched this movie with have called it like a hard film to follow. They struggle with the different dream levels and things like that, which is understandable. There's a lot going on. But if you watch the movie, every single dream level is referred to as another level down, right? So they talk about when they're warning everybody about limbo, they say, you know, when you fall into limbo, the only things there are whatever's been built there by someone you're sharing the dream with that's been there before. So like in this dream, it's Cobb. The stuff that's left over for in his mind about what was built in limbo, that's all that's there. But they call it down there, right? It's this place where it's the ultimate self-absorption. At one point, Cobb talks about him and his wife's experience in limbo when they're sharing dreams together. And he calls it, he says they were like gods, right? He called, so it's this, they could do whatever they want. They could build whatever they want. They could make buildings that don't fit in the landscape or that they couldn't do otherwise. They're architects and they love to build things and they could create and do whatever they wanted.
Outside of physics.
They could manipulate things. And it was basically the ultimate self-absorption, like what you said earlier, that when you're in these dreams, especially, and this is especially true of limbo, you're like God. You are God, doing whatever you want, manipulating things and however you want to do them, and making your own world. But they refer to it as down, like which with each level of the dream, you're going down. So with level one, you've got the van that's driving with Yusuf. He's the guy that's, you know, eventually it drives off the bridge and it's falling, you know, and that's a big part. That's a big portion of the movie is the van in free fall. And then level two, you got the hotel and the elevators. And then you got the third level, which is the fortress with all the snow. And it's where Fisher's dad is in the hospital. And every time they talk about those levels, they're going down another level. They're descending. They're not ascending to anything. They're descending to even more depths of self-absorption, self-godhood. And so the ultimate form of that is limbo. And so what I think we get in limbo, what it kind of gives us a picture of is hell. This point of ultimate self-absorption that you can't be rescued from, right? There's this point where it's the absence of reality and it's just complete and utter delusion. And what happens in limbo? You lose all sense of reality. You lose your grip on reality. You lose it all. That's what happens to Cobb's wife, right? She loses her grip on reality. And even when she's not in limbo, it's what ultimately leads to her death, is that she believes her world isn't real. It's that simple idea that, and that's the idea that Cobb that planted there, but it was her desire to stay in this state of self-absorption, this state of delusion in limbo, is what ultimately leads to her death. And so we get a picture of that. And another way of thinking about that is the absence, the complete and utter absence of God's grace. So there's something called common grace. And that's, imagine our world if all men were as bad as they could be, if all men were as self-absorbed and sinful as they could be. Right? If everyone was acted as depraved as their hearts would allow them to be, but God is restraining some of that evil. God is restraining some of that selfishness in our world to bring about his purposes in the world. So it's called common grace. So like Matthew 5:45, For he makes his sun rise on the evil and the good and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. So the nature and the gifts that God's provided in creation are here to be used by both the just and the unjust, by the good and by the evil. And God's giving grace by allowing those things to be present for both groups of people. Luke 6:35 says, "But love your enemies and do good and lend, expecting nothing in return, and your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High, for he is kind to the ungrateful and the evil." That's God's common grace. That's God's grace, the fact that the evil aren't immediately destroyed right now, or the fact that they're not as evil as they could possibly be. Because we can look around the world and look how many bad things happen, but we should be shocked that it's not even much worse because of the depravity of man, because of the sinfulness of our hearts, because of the corruption that is inside of us. It could be so much worse than it actually is. And God in his grace is restraining this. So we can look at limbo as the absence of that restraint, the absence of God's grace. And it's the ultimate form of self-absorption, self-governance, self-reality. It's whoever is the dreamer is the center of it all. So it's a place where ultimate evil can thrive and where reality falls to the wayside. Because what determines reality? God. And we have to acknowledge God to ultimately know what reality is. Mm-hmm. So in limbo, we get that picture, a glimpse of complete and utter self-absorption and the evil that in the absence of God's grace, we could see in the world. What do you think?
I love it. I think that, I don't even think that you have to go as far to say that it's a depiction of hell, because I think that to a lot of, truth and reality in the world and society culture that we live in, that's kind of where we're at.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we are currently in a state where we had to do a podcast on the question, what is a woman?
Right.
You know, I know Acts talks about crooked generations. Like, we're in it.
Yeah.
If there ever was one, if there is ever going to be one, we're in it. And it's very obvious. So that ideology, any ideology that is shoveled these days is just that self-absorption, just to the core, to where you're so bought in that you can't even see the vain philosophy of your own worldview. Mm-hmm. You know, the holes in your worldview.
Right.
You won't allow yourself to see it. You've been given over to your own depravity, like it talks about in Romans, and your heart's probably been hardened, and some people just aren't gonna be able to be reached by the gospel.
For sure.
and you know, it's just not gonna be able to work on them. So
God's wrath and judgment,
but I totally
is being
agree.
Given over to your own depravity.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
For sure.
So I think we're there. I think that that's why it's important to continue to use the word to convince and to convict.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So
and then
absolutely. That's good stuff, man. I think that's a great thing to pull. I didn't pull that at all. Not at all. I think that's really good.
And then the other part of that is setting limbo aside, this is still true for limbo, but it's really true of all of the dream levels in the movie. How do you get up to reality in the movie? What has to happen? Or what typically happens in order for somebody to wake up in reality?
Oh, I think where you're going is great. I don't know if this is exactly where you're going, but you have the kick, right?
Yeah.
So it's a form of, it would be a form of a correction or a, I guess, go ahead and say the word that you were going to use, because you have to be jolted or you have to be, to some degree, there's a confrontation with that kick where you're confronted with the harsh reality and you're awakened.
Yeah, so
it's an awakening.
Yeah,
almost.
And I wasn't actually even going with the kick, but you're exactly right. And it fits perfectly within what I'm saying. But yeah, so if we look at the kicks, you have to be jolted awake. Something has to cause you to wake up. But then on the other side, just go to the first scene of the movie. They find out that So Saito finds out that Cobb is there to steal from him, and Arthur's his partner, and they find that out, and Maul comes into the dream. The wife comes into the dream and says, you know, we know that if we kill him, he'll just wake up in real life, right? So one, so you have the kick, something that jolts you awake. But then the other example of waking up in reality is dying in the dream, right? So you get this image that dying to yourself. So each level of the dream is self-absorption, selfishness, and you're descending down. But then to get up is dying to self and awakening to reality. So, you know, the Bible says, if anyone will follow me, Jesus says, if anyone will follow me, take up his cross, right? That's a call to come die. That's a call to follow him in his death.
Right.
So, you know, that's an example of repentance.
So how do you explain? I know. Yeah. And I agree with that. And I know not every application is going to be perfect, yeah. But didn't Saito, right? Saito?
Mm-hmm.
That his name? So Saito, didn't, like, when he gets shot, didn't they say, yeah, that he can't die because he'll die in real life too? Or was it that he wouldn't die?
No, they didn't say he'd die in real life. He'd get stuck in limbo. Right.
Okay. So I just wanted to make sure I had that right.
Yeah, the risk to Saito was that if he dies in that particular dream level, then he falls into limbo because the dream's not over. Because everyone in the dream is not there. But for some reason, and maybe this is another part where the movie gets kind of confusing, but oh no, it was because they were on sedatives. The sedatives wouldn't allow them to wake up if they were killed in the dream levels. But at every other point,
okay. I remember
they, if you died in the dream, you woke up in reality. So it was the adding the sedatives into this to because of the long flight. That's what made it that way. So I remember that.
Gotcha.
But in all other circumstances, you die in the dream, you wake up in reality.
Gotcha.
So, but then
it's the exception, not the rule.
Do what?
It's the exception, not the rule.
Yeah.
Got it.
So beyond that, do you have anything you want to add so far? Cause I've got a lot more, to go if you don't.
No, keep rolling, man. I have one major thing that I took away from the movie, but you can keep rolling.
So I think the scenes that involve Cobb and his wife, where there's that confrontation between the two of them. So it's Cobb's mental image of his wife and Cobb confronting each other. That happens a few times, but the main time, the biggest moment in the movie, I think, is near the end. It's kind of the climax where Cobb is in limbo and they've gone to the apartment that Cobb and his wife live in. And his wife has Fisher held captive there, right? And there's this scene. So we're talking about the nature of reality and self-absorption going into further into this delusion. And what brings Cobb out of that delusion? What Cobb is faced with a choice. He's faced with this choice where he wants in his heart, he wants desperately to be with his wife, even if it is just his mental image of her. He's fighting. He knows it's not real. He's aware of it, but he wants desperately, because of his grief, he wants desperately to be with his wife again because he loves her. And he knows that ultimately he feels the guilt of her death. He feels responsible for it. And he feels like he's the one who caused it. And he blames himself. And he wants to be with her again because he loves her. But then there's this point where he has the opportunity to choose to stay in the dream, stay in limbo with his mental projection, or to finish the mission and move on, move out of that, move on past his grief into reality. And what is it that he eventually chooses to move on, but what is it that allows him to overcome that? And there's a really, really good quote. Cobb's wife says, "You keep telling yourself what you know. but what do you feel? And that's the temptation. That's the temptation that Cobb has in his own mind. Because remember, this isn't actually his wife. It's his projection, his mental image, his memory of his wife that's saying this. You keep telling yourself what you know, but what do you feel? And what does Cobb feel? He feels like he's depressed and saddened over his wife's death, and he wants to be with her. He wants to see her. He wants to stay with her, even if it is in this dream. That's what he feels. And that's the question that causes him to be confronted with this choice. Am I going to choose this fake reality and be with my wife, or am I going to face reality, which is that she's gone? And he desires so deeply to be with her. But what is it that ultimately causes him to choose? It's he sees and realizes the beauty of something. He sees and he realizes his mind is awakened to the beauty. And so this corresponds with a non-believer coming to faith in Christ. A non-believer coming to faith in Christ happens because they're awakened to the beauty of what Christ accomplished on the cross. They're awakened to the beauty and magnificence of what he did for us on our behalf, doing what we can't do, paying our penalty. They see the beauty in that, and they see the beauty in the grace of God providing a way for us to be united with him for all of eternity. And that's exactly what draws Cobb out of this delusion, because his response to the question, again, I'll read the question again. You keep telling yourself, what do you know? But what do you feel? So he has to choose. Do I go with what I feel, or do I go with what I know? And Cobb's response is, and if I'm getting this, I've got the screenplay right here behind me, so I pulled it right out of that. But he says, I wish more than anything, but I can't imagine you with all your complexity, all your perfection, all your imperfection. Look at you. You're just a shade of my real wife. You're the best I can do, but I'm sorry. You're just not good enough. He realizes that the mental image that he has in his mind can't hold up. The mental image that he has in his mind doesn't meet the actual beauty that his wife did. The image that he has in his mind doesn't match the real level of magnificence that he saw in his one true love, his wife. And he's awakened to this reality that, yes, he misses his wife. Yes, this projection is the best he can do, but it's not good enough. It's not the real thing. And he realizes that the true beauty of his wife wouldn't allow him to stay with this imposter. So when we're stuck in our sin, when we're dead in our sin, we're choosing all kinds of imposter gods. We're choosing all kinds of things, worshiping them, thinking that they will satisfy us, thinking that they'll bring us pleasure, thinking that they'll bring us good things, joy, happiness, whatever it might be, success, whatever thing it might be. We sin because we think we get a wonderful reward on the other side of that sin, and we love it. But when we come to Christ, what we see is that whatever that is that we're worshiping, that we're running to, it's just not good enough. And we actually compare it to the real living God, who is absolutely magnificent. And we realize that none of these things over here that I'm using as projections can hold up. None of them can provide the joy, the satisfaction, the peace that the one true God provided when he sent his son into the world to die for me. The beauty contained in God outmatches the beauty contained anywhere else. And when we look into that beauty, we can't help others. And that's exactly what Cobb does at the end of this movie. He says, you're just an imposter. The beauty that I long for isn't here. So he turns and he continues on, and he gets back to his children where he does see beauty, right? That's what he sees, his children's faces, and he's confronted with real beauty again. And that's, so that's a parallel to us seeing Christ, seeing God as the ultimate beauty, as the ultimate magnificence, the ultimate source of joy and pleasure.
Yeah, and that kind of fits right in with what I got from the movie, or what I kind of extracted was the, I think they did a good job making the viewer feel the emotional pull of, do I choose what I desire from the emotional aspect of it, or do I choose reality?
Yeah.
And I think that's a perfect stepping stone to talk about how sometimes it's just so hard to choose between sin, whatever that sin that you struggle with is, and not committing it.
Yeah.
That's the big thing, you know, and it's in many scenes in the movie where that it's just that turmoil of like, why is this so hard to choose?
Yep.
It's like, I know what to do. I know what's right, but like, I just, it's that tension, I think they did a good job Definitely. Capturing
yeah,
that.
Yeah, they did. Yeah. And it builds the entire time.
It builds
to
throughout
that
the
moment.
Entire movie. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. And that's what I got out of it is whether it's pornography, whether it's, you know, anything. I mean, any lying, cheating, any type of sin, you know, dishonoring your wife, dishonoring your husband, dishonoring your parents. Yeah. We did a podcast on that. I think it's so hard. Sometimes, like for me, I like to argue. That's what I like to do. And sometimes it's not respectful. And it's that bait. Like, you know, when you're presented that bait and it's like,
it's
right there in front of me. It's like, I gotta take it. I want it so bad. And then like you're left with nothing.
Right.
You're just it's you choose to do it because you think you're going to get this fulfillment, and then you're just left empty.
Because you're seeking and I think, fulfillment from somewhere where there is none. Right?
Correct. And there's no instant gratification in choosing Christ. And I think that's the point. Yeah. The gratification comes later.
Yeah.
The gratification comes in having confidence that he died for you, that you're standing up, you're dying to yourself, that you're being sanctified, that you've been justified through him, through faith alone, and it can't be on
right.
us. Yep. You know, the Bible says that our works are like filthy rags right. to God, and I think that I think the movie did a good job capturing that. The other movie, it's not a good movie. I mean, the message is good, but Fireproof with Kirk Cameron.
Right. Not a well-made movie.
Not a good movie.
But,
not a right. well-made movie, low budget, whatever. But when he's struggling, he's sitting on the couch. He's like, God, why is this so hard? Yeah. You remember that scene where he's sitting on the couch and he's staring at his computer and he's trying to choose his wife or the porn? And he's like, wow, that's kind of the same. Like, it made me think of that scene when I watched that. In Inception, where it's like, what? Like, I know what to, I know. I need to do this, but I really want to do this.
Yeah, the way, in Inception, the way Leonardo DiCaprio delivers that last line, that I wish more than anything, but I can't imagine you with all your complexity, all your perfection, and the way he delivers that line, like he did incredible. Like, I just his delivery of that line makes me feel that even more. Like, the moment in the movie is tense and you're going to feel it regardless, but he just hit the way that he delivers it, his acting, it just raised it to another level and made me feel it even more. So,
yeah, I think that it was interesting that it was almost as if he was trying to cut to the heart of the, what am I trying to say? It was almost like he was trying to be mean and hateful.
Yeah.
When he said that. It wasn't like I'm sorry. Like, because, you know, normally trying to appeal to an audience, I think they would have written that scene as him being nice to the false depiction of his wife, and it would have been like, oh, I love you, but you're just not the full thing, and I'm gonna let you go, and it would have been this emotional thing moment. But instead we get anger and we get hatred. I hate this false depiction of you, because it's not
that's
good
really
enough.
Good, because in essence he's turning away from himself, right?
Yes.
He's saying it's not necessarily self-hatred, but it's understanding that he can't find fulfillment in himself. And he's the Bible, you know,
because even his depiction of his wife, he hates.
Yeah.
And it's his depiction. So a lot of people watching the movie, just to clarify, it's not him hating a false version of his wife. It's him hating his false version of his wife.
Yeah.
And it's powerful. I think that's why you feel it's his own mind. Yeah.
So that even kind of goes hand in hand with the dream levels being, you know, self-absorption. And he's dying in a sense, even though this isn't a death like it is of elsewhere in the movie, in order to get back to reality, he's dying to himself again. Right?
Yep.
He's shedding that false desire, or that desire for something that can't satisfy. He's turning away from it and turning to the things that can, which is ultimate reality, actual reality, which is
And the further you go down, the more grandiose act of dying to yourself it takes to get up.
Just be jarred. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's just like a little kick at the top to go from level one back to reality. But if you're in limbo, you have to tell the figment of your imagination of the wife that you once loved that you hate the false depiction of her. And then the kicks just seem to be more grandiose the further down you go. So you have to die more to yourself to get out of the depths of your own depraved mind.
Yep. Good stuff.
That's really good stuff, man. I think the less we talk before the episodes, the better the episodes get.
Yeah.
It's great. Anything else, Nick? I mean, we're at an hour and five.
No, I think that's
pretty much all I got.
We could probably talk for a long time about it. It's a great movie. I'd encourage people to watch it if you haven't yet. And you probably have no idea what we're talking about if you haven't watched it. So watch it. It's a fantastic movie. Even if I can listen to us again, but you can watch it on HBO Max and you can rent it or buy it or do whatever. But great, great movie.
Yep. All right, guys. Not sure what the next movie is going to be, but I am Parker. And this is Nick signing off this episode 14. We will post on the Facebook page. If you guys if you guys aren't subscribed to our YouTube channel, please do that. Hit the notification bell so you don't miss an episode. And then if you want to head over to our Facebook page, like that. And we want to, you know, just create a good community to where we have good conversations and discussions on the Facebook page the best you can with a character count, just to create a good community. You know, we love reviewing movies. We love talking about films. We love talking about the plot lines. Obviously, it's what the whole podcast is about. We want to get you guys involved in that too. If you want to support us, please head over to our Patreon page. It will be linked in this description below. If you want to support us, you can support us there to help get cameras and make the podcast better, easier to watch, and stuff like that. So we would appreciate it if you did that. We'd feel very blessed. But outside of that, did I miss anything,
nope,
Nick?
I think that's it.
All right, we'll catch you guys next week.